Hi everyone. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series.
So we will not have an intermission tonight. That means you should feel free to get up, use the restroom, head to the bar if you need to replenish your drink. In the middle of the reading, just be aware that people are reading, so try to keep the volume a little bit down as you do that.
And of course, please turn off your cell phones. And if you would please join me in welcoming our introducer, which I have a special introduction tonight that will be read by Shaw Patton.
Yay! I'm Shaw, but I am reading a script from Robert's partner. Hi, my name is Nedab, and I am Persian from Iran. I have been dating Robert Powers for more than 2 years. On our first date, the super shy guy shook hands, said hi, and looked down. It was raining that night. We walked over a bridge, and Robert was walking with me, holding an umbrella with a giant banana on it. We danced and kissed that night. Then we adopted two cats and became a family in Purdue University, Indiana. Note, don't try to kiss your partner in a pool in Indiana because it's considered as PDA there. About his past life, I know that once he got up and flew to China to teach English, his stay took just a little longer than expected, as long as 7 fucking years, and he ended up with a phone company there. Robert bought the cheapest ticket to the U.S., which brought him to Indiana. He started to become a professional writer there, and to write like a motherfucker, as his mug says. About his personal life and habits, Robert makes good burgers, but he puts too much red velvet from them. He's always listening to something, even in the shower, never listen to what you say. It is better for you to put your words in an audiobook if you really want him to listen to you. Robert has 2 pillows because he believes the second one makes him feel wealthy in life. Every morning he writes on his typewriter as fast as a horse running in a derby. That is when the cats get crazy and start wrestling around him. Most of the times it is fun to hear Robert and the cats in the morning. Let's ask his roommate, Robert, later than you're sure. Robert's roommate here? Yeah. Okay. We're officially pre-engaged now. Powers of 2018. Our ring was a leaf from an ivy tree in Florida. Then I got suspicious of my knowledge of English, and I looked for the word pre-engagement on Google. I found nothing. I told Robert, and he suggested to promote our status to post-pre-engagement. I asked Google again, and Google froze this time. The lesson from this, let him use his imagination and make words since he is a writer. Otherwise, things might simply get too complicated with him. Lesson 2, buy her big motherfucker. Robert is such a capable writer that he can write about a variety of topics, like a woman who is scared of cockroaches in China. Mr. Trump immediately boycotted Robert's novel after he learned how to control F words in text, and unfortunately, Trump found too many Chinas in the novel. Robert decided to replace all China with Iran because of the respect he has for my nationality. Trump's reaction to what is nowadays called the travel ban. Thanks, Robert. Robert, everyone.
Hello. I guess the Dawson Society. I will tell her that. So I'm going to read from a short story. In workshop earlier today, I was like, I'm going to read from a part of it. I don't know what part. And Elizabeth was just like, just read from the beginning. So I think that's a good idea. I'm just going to read and then stop at a reasonable point. So, it's called Almost Happiness. For their second date, 3 days after they first met, Kelvin texted Missy at 10 a.m. asking her to meet him, quote, around dusk at this upscale pubco bistro I know right on the East River. In bed with the blinds drawn and his boxers and Argyle socks, he carefully typed out he dined there many times since moving to the NYC area. This place had unmissable Saturday specials on Moscato wine to go along with live boozy new jazz on an open-air patio that had a breathtaking view of the Brooklyn Bridge. Dinner would be his treat, and she could wear whatever she wanted. He hadn't been completely honest with her, but wanted to be. He felt they had so much more to discuss about their lives. He wrote, quote, "Right before the sun sets, while the city lights twinkling against the deep oranges and dark blues on the horizon, is so beautiful," he ended the screen-length message, quote, "It's like being in an Edward Hopper painting." He'd Google artists that paint beautiful sunsets, looking for a name that he thought might impress her. He checked and rechecked his words, changing any bit of the message he thought too stuffy or dour, then hit send and began anxiously waiting for a reply that wouldn't come for an hour, completely determined to simply ignore emails or texts sent from work or anyone else. Kelvin had managed to sleep a little right before the sun started coming up, waking as his bare-bones, white-walled high-rise to the apartment became awash in lazy sunlight. He could hear down in the streets the same group of neighborhood kids that was always playing with the same few toy-class dogs. A warm late autumn wind rustled the tops of the honey locust trees below his one big open window that looked out over old red and white brick buildings toward the shiny metal of Manhattan 3 miles away, where he had been commuting by subway, sometimes daily for almost a month, as a new hire at one of the big four accounting firms, a job he got out of a graduate internship program he felt by working himself nearly to death. His specialty was the strategic management of redundant human resources in the wake of hostile corporate takeovers. His workload, some of it gathered in a splayed rainbow of colored folders by the foot of the bed and then on the apartment's one small, recently put together dining table, had him sorting through grandfathered pension plans for small and medium-sized enterprises in America and Canada. In another 5 months, his probationary period would be up, and if he continued to, quote, perform, quote, splendidly ruthlessly, as several of his immediate supervisors had thus far rated his performance on group emails, he expected to be shipped off for 6 months, maybe a full year more, to either South America or Southeast Asia, where he would downsize large swaths of blue-collar workers whose language he didn't speak, while creatively cutting down the resulting severance. His other phone buzzed with a text from Charity. It's capital C, isn't it? Without looking at the message, Kelvin completely silenced the phone and flipped the display down. The night before, on their weekly group video chat session, before Kelvin headed out on another sleepless, brooding nighttime stroll for hours running nearby park, his and his wife's families back in Omaha were again thrilled at how he described his company's culture on top of his prospects for promotion. "Real hard work and grit," he told them. "Don't get overlooked here or unrewarded." The plan was for Cherry, his wife of 2 years, to finish out her final fall term teaching English at the middle school both of them had gone to, and rejoin him permanently in the Big Apple in time for New Year's. "You make sure you're keeping your chin up and your head in the game," she cheerily told him. "I don't want to get back there to see you've been keeping all kinds of new work troubles for me." Even as a flat, low-res, sometimes buffering digital image, he could tell she was genuinely worried about him, about his thinking, but didn't want to make it an issue right then and there in front of their parents. Charity asked him if he'd given any more thought to buying or adopting a puppy they could raise together. Kelvin said he had, but hadn't gone looking. He said after sleeping in the next day, he'd probably spend his first real Saturday off in a long while doing nothing but continuing to pack all their things. "Everything here is still a big old mess, the same since you left it," he said, "and I want you to be happy when you get here for good." Charity's parents showed Kelvin the postcard he mailed them had arrived, a photo of the Freedom Tower shining at night. "Wish you were here" on the back in black marker. Kelvin's parents told him to make sure he was eating healthy, to let them know more about the new Roman Catholic parish he found whenever he had the time. His mother said they'd bring his younger sister and brother when they first came to visit, maybe around the same time as Charity's move. Kelvin said they could discuss a visit later. Everyone wished one another a good night and a happy weekend and signed off. To stop himself from worrying, he'd made a mistake in so soon and so directly asking Missy to see him. Kelvin rose and went to the above sink mirror in the dark and cramped white tiled bathroom. He checked and scratched at the fresh stubble on his chin and the patch of gray hair on one side of his head that began forming not long after learning he got the job. On their first date, Missy leaned across the table and touched the gray. "Hey, this is clearly from stress." It'd been 2 weeks since Kelvin decided to stop cold turkey taking his Zoloft. Charity told him to stop. To wait to stop until she got there, but she said the decision was up to him. He blamed the new chemistry in his head for not being able to get much sleep. And when he did sleep, he knew it was likely he'd suffer through another incarnation of the nighttime Icarus dream, the one where his arms are great metal wings and he's soaring proud and naked through an endlessly starry night. The last time, a sudden bath of hot moonlight abruptly denuded him of all his feathers and he fell, the rushing atmosphere roaring in his ears as he plummeted toward a perfectly ruffled expanse of bright silvery cloud, which he tumbled straight through to face an infinitely vast ocean, light glinting on its surface in spots like scattered jewels. He fell and fell, waiting for a disintegrating smack that would never come. He fell further and further away from the churning clouds, the giant moon, the spread of stars, until there was nothing left but a suspended sensation of frozen, heavy dread, and he woke, the feeling stuck in his chest like lead. Charity had made him promise to look for a new therapist, or at least try to get back in touch with his old one, but he felt he didn't have the time. He wanted to take charge of this huge new life on his own terms, living so far from home for the first time. After accompanying Charity to the airport and waiting until her plane safely took off, Kelvin returned for his first night alone in the new apartment, opened and unopened moving boxes everywhere, and he found himself thinking how he now had the chance to become the man God had always meant for him to become. He was going to be his family's provider and a father, like Charity wanted. He knew he had to do whatever it would take to make their marriage work, no matter how much the prospects scared him, the idea of raising a child, all the continuing complications. Kelvin checked again for a reply text from Missy that wasn't there. He said about the quietly draining work of unpacking and positioning all the belongings he and Charity had brought with them on the three-day drive. Framed family photos spanning two decades, including their wedding on her uncle's farm. Just about every music CD they'd ever owned. He couldn't remember the last time either of listened to any of them. Charity's unorganized stack of true crime and memoir nonfiction. His sociology and business administration textbooks from 4.5 years of undergrad and 2 years of grad. All the board and table games he didn't like, never liked, and wished he could get rid of without telling her. Light, Boggle, Risk, Twister, Operation. Dozens of them, some of them never played, some of them never opened. And then he remembered Missy, 3 nights before, telling him about her wanting to become a competitive Scrabble player. Their first date coming to a close later than both expected. They were outstanding in a little dimly lit alleyway waiting for her Uber to arrive, and they were filling the silence with awkward chatter. She was smoking compulsively from an electronic cigarette that glowed neon blue on the end of the drag. After exhaling a long, billowing puff of vapor in his direction, she said, half sneering, she'd be more than happy to teach him all her Scrabble strategies if he could stomach her completely demolishing him over and over again. She grinned and licked her lips, and Kelvin felt weak in the knees. Never in his life, he told himself, had he been so unable to stop thinking so intensely about someone he'd met up with, not since he was married. He didn't know what he was going to do if Missy didn't want to see him again. At the least, he needed her to be right in front of him just the one more time so he could prove to himself that he was who he knew he was, a proud and devoted husband, a one-day father-to-be. He was determined to stave off what he felt for her before it got any worse. He was absolutely sure they had a Scrabble board somewhere in one of the boxes. All he had to do was find it. This means new section. What about the weather? Missy texted back. Kelvin stopped his watering and rearranging of Charity's houseplants to check his new phone and saw it was her. The wind through the apartment's one window had been picking up. Away from the city, toward the Atlantic, the sky was now overcast, gloomy. Kelvin's weather app showed high winds, a strong chance of thunderstorms in the early evening lasting until tomorrow, Sunday maybe until Monday. All week, smoke marble skies had been threatened to pour, but so far hadn't. It's just rain, he wrote. I'll bring an extra umbrella. I'll melt, Missy wrote, adding a witch emoji. Kelvin wanted to lie, tell her he was leaving in a few days for an overseas business trip, that he had Scrabble at his place and she could come over and crush him at it. He had time to go out and buy the game, along with a few new bottles of liquor. Missy continued, but I'm not working tonight, so why not? / new message. If we're lucky, there'll be huge waves and we'll get washed out to sea, they'll never find us. We'll sneak into our own funerals and flee to South America and start over with new lives. She tagged the final text with a beach emoji. Sound good? Her confidently direct flirtations continued to bring an unstoppable flush of weightless warmth to Kelvin's cheeks and chest, a sudden delight that was so piercing it felt surprising, shocking, somehow unfathomable. The two of them had matched in a dating app Kelvin installed on a new phone he purchased not long after Charity left. He never tried online dating, but was curious after hearing about the various lewd and prudish exploits and misadventures of several male co-workers at his level, the only friends he'd made after the move, while walking back to the office after a late lunch. How with a few decent photos of themselves, they were quickly able to meet up with young women at bars and cafes around towns after trading jokey pickup lines, like, are you my appendix? Because this feeling you're giving me makes me want to take you out. Flings outside marriage for Kelvin had always been about feeding a greater sustainable happiness for his wife, for her family, for his own family, now also for his future childhood children. Hell, he thought, now even for the dog they were going to raise. In Omaha, he picked the right nights to drive to Sioux City or Des Moines or Kansas City or Lincoln. making sure to avoid the same bars twice in a row and always use a new name. Someone he could forget being after a single day. But here, he didn't have a car yet, let alone the time to get away. So he downloaded the app, uploaded a few subway selfies of himself in his work clothes, face largely obscured, set his account to look for both men and women, and set his profile name as Boris. New to the city? / You certainly look like fresh meat to me. Missy wrote in her first few messages responding to his profile, which was, new to the city, don't yet know what I'm doing here. Her profile read, give me sunshine, give me red wine, looking for new friends and fun, non-op trains. He held the new phone under his cubicle desk as a flurry of more messages from her lit on the screen. BDW Boris, you don't look Russian, / If I had to, I'd guess Boricua, which is Puerto Rican, living in mainland. Am I right? In any case, yet sexy. The photos on Missy's account to Kelvin were thrilling. Once a motion-blurred shot of her standing behind a nightclub bar, mid-pour, making a purple martini and beaming glittering ruby red lipstick. Another a flashy smirking selfie of her wearing a black strapless dress and holding up a tube of black lipstick in the above sink mirror of a packed women's toilet. Young women to her left and right leaning forward and applying different shades of red to her skirts. The next, a close-up of her arm wrestling a hip-looking, bushy-bearded young man at a smoky bar table. Amethyst contact lenses shining in her smiling, straining eyes. Missy had straight-cropped, strong blonde hair, wore oodles of mascara and dark eyeshadow, and alternating fire engine red and lavender blue fingernails, and colorful, detailed tattoos running up and down pale, toned arms. She was the same age as he was, but looked to be taller. In the last photo, he saw Missy curled up on a plush cafe sofa chair, mock attempting to hide behind a thick paperback tome entitled Being in Nothingness, while also sipping from an outsized cappuccino cup, eyes toward the ceiling. I think you're too cool for me, Kelvin wrote back. So, she replied, that only matters if you make it matter. Over his lunch hour in the same break room, away from prying eyes, Kelvin kept up the conversation, learning she was from a small town in Ohio, but she had been living in Brooklyn for a few years as a bartender. He eventually began opening up to her a stream of messages about how difficult he thought his new job was, how a very large part of him felt he wasn't exactly destined for greatness in such a high-pressure, high-stakes environment. He told a sympathetic Missy he found his work clinical and tedious. He lamented a work-to-life ratio of approximately 1-0. Long-term, he wasn't so sure he belonged. The only thing he liked about the job, he wrote, was the prospect of all the international travel he'd be doing, the constant escapes. They working you to the bone? She asked, adding a winking emoji. You honestly have no idea, he excitedly typed back. I'm already going gay. Kelvin quickly corrected himself. Sorry, typo, I'm already going gray. Ha ha, def not gay. Thumbs too big. He tagged the message with a smiley and sank nervously into himself. He thought immediately about deleting the app, even formatting the phone or quickly sliding it as broken pieces into the bathroom trash can. Or he could just block her, forget her, match with someone else. He made himself think back to the work he'd been assigned that day. Helping research and design a key account PowerPoint presentation be given that night by a company VP he'd never met, as part of a birthday dinner, of all things, or even hire company executive at some fancy venue in Brooklyn, described as, quote, attendance optional in a mass email. As a new hire on probation, Kelvin knew the event was in reality mandatory. Everyone on the financial analysis team he had been placed on was still getting to know. He felt it was important they know he was a clean-cut, sociable team player, a bona fide future 1%er like some of them already were. It was rumored the CEO would be making an appearance. If Kelvin cared at all about his standing at work, he knew he had to be there, that he had to show up with a clear head. LOL, Missy wrote back, you're funny, / Meet later for a quick beer tonight before I go to work? The directness of the request surprised Kelvin. He hesitated, unsure how to reply. You're not too busy, Missy added. I have a work dinner thing tonight, Kelvin. Maybe free right before. Perfect, she wrote. They exchanged phone numbers. She sent him an address she said was a rock club. I'm friends with all the bartenders and bouncers, / I'm sure they'll find you cute too. He texted back, I'll be there with bells on. LOL, Missy replied, you were kind of adorable. That day, right after work, en route to meet Missy in person for the first time, Kelvin found himself hugging his new blue faux leather attache case Charity had bought and mailed him, replete with more work orders to add to the piles, crowding the end of his bed. He stared out his cab window at the slow-moving traffic, rationalizing the urgency he felt in wanting to see Missy. He told himself he'd been through this before. Just because he was now living in a new city, that didn't mean anything about him in fundamentally changed. The plan was to meet Missy just the once, have a light beer, pleasant chat. They'd talk about how the both of them were transplant New Yorkers. He'd asked what the toughest part of adjusting to life in such a big city had been, and he proceeded normally on to his work function. He mused they might even manage to become buddies, but told himself it didn't matter. He didn't care. You were in control, he calmly repeated it himself, again and again. He loosened the knot on his tie and unbuttoned the first few buttons on his new dress shirt, but still felt like he couldn't breathe, like someone was sitting on his chest. He knew what he was doing, what he was thinking was wrong, the necessary evil he knew better than to dwell on. And then his old phone rang, crooning the pre-programmed soft melody Charity had chosen. Whenever she called, the image displayed was of her at their wedding, off on her own in the tall grass and still in most of her wedding dress. The outdoor reception at that point in full swing. A hand, whose Kelvin never found out, holding up from out of frame a clear glass plate shining in the warm late afternoon sun with a neat red icing laced white cube of wedding cake on it. And she's smiling and laughing and trying to blow out the sparkling candle stuck into the slice. Kelvin still winced at how she'd wanted a trick candle on every served piece of cake to be lit by either her or him. That was meant to commemorate her special day in a much more fun and memorable way. Kelvin remembered this thing, continuing to think the idea stupid, something an adolescent girl might doodle in her diary after daydreaming about a superstar teen heartthrob carrying her off into a rainbowed sunset atop a windy unicorn. You going to get that? The cab driver asked. Charity, his wife, had called using the video call feature on her phone. It was clear she was having a hard time grading a slew of sloppily handwritten essays. You have to help me, she said, showing him the messy phone book thick stack on their old coffee table. She read him the prompt. Analyze the relationship between Charlotte and the spider in a 5-paragraph essay format. God, I hate this. Kelvin couldn't be comfortable in the cab's back seat. He wanted to go home first, change out of his suit for another that didn't feel like it stank from a day's worth of flop sweat. Are you okay, she asked. I'm fine, he said. How late are you going to be out? It could be a long night. There's no telling what kind of mischief the guys I work with will want to get up to after this thing is done. Are they going to make you go out drinking? No, I wouldn't let, because you can't let them do that again. The week prior, Kelvin had gone out with a group of new hires until 1 or 2 a.m. on a weekday. The mess had been stumbling from one uptown Manhattan bar to the next, a very vocal minority wanting to pursue the slosh lot of them to find a strip club. You're the only motherfucker here with a wife who's going to find out, one of them announced to Kelvin, arms out as if waiting for someone to nail him to a cross. The next day, he told Charity everything that had happened, even the little white lines of what had to be cocaine. He saw some of them doing in the back of one of the clubs. Charity was mortified. Did you do any of it? She asked. Of course not, Kelvin laughed. You need to make new friends. The light ahead turned green and the cab inched forward a bit more. The traffic Kelvin knew likely wouldn't let up until they reached the Brooklyn Bridge. I should get out and walk the rest of the way. They said it's supposed to rain there tonight, Kelvin remembered. I got the umbrella you sent me. That morning, Kelvin still couldn't believe it. He received by overnight express a big, sturdy black umbrella. I was waiting for you to tell me, she said. I saw it online. It was delivered. I thought maybe the delivery man forged your signature and stole it. You think of everything. Are you going to use it tonight? Kelvin wasn't going to tell her about his breaking of the umbrella. It had arrived right as he was about to leave for work. He opened it and closed it in the early morning light, opened it and closed it again, held it gingerly like it was a golf club, gripped it tightly like it was a two-handed bastard sword. Pointed it at his view of Manhattan like it was a fencer's key at hay. Whistling merrily about the apartment, he held it like it was a cane, swinging it around by its curved handle. He then raised it up and brought it down hard against the back of the new sofa, again and again, until its bar bent and its fastening hooks broke into bits of metal tinkling across the corner. I left it at home, Kelvin said. Well, that was a silly thing to do. Charity read him half of a student's essay she didn't like, stopping herself with a frustrated sigh. She asked him to tell her something new, something interesting about where they would soon be living together, something she hadn't heard yet. Kelvin described a nighttime through the city by the elevators on his floor, 40-plus stories up. Every day I'm waiting for the car ride to go home. It takes forever. I'm standing there, looking out at this special silhouette I always see in the skyline. Oh? Yeah, it's in the shape of a beautiful young woman, about 5'5", flowing golden hair. That is, whenever she lets her hair. It's always looking like she's holding her arms out and calling out to the heavens, oh glory, like during Sunday service. It's the darndest thing, really. Charity was laughing. Sometimes, Kelvin said, it even looks like she's grading papers. He knew she loved it when he told her he was thinking about her. He knew her saving grace was how easy it was to make her laugh. The city skyline looks like me? That's right, Kelvin said. You're always here, even when you're not. I love you, she said. I love you. After Charity had fully moved into their New York apartment, after she'd started tutoring and found a substitute teaching job at an Orthodox Jewish private middle school, she'd been told would likely lead to a full-time academic year position, Kelvin would tell her about his meeting Missy in the flesh for the first time. He told her past midnight on a starless weekday, Easter Sunday a few weeks away, all the moving boxes finally gone, both of them still in their work clothes, and sitting on the new bedspread she'd picked out. He'd tell her he wanted to be completely honest with her for the first time in his life. He'd hold Charity's wrists and tell her he'd been meeting with men since before they were married. He did it, he'd say, to prove to himself an undying faith in their marital bond. That was it. There was nothing else to his meetups, and she had to believe him. Through deep, burning tears, Kelvin would tell Charity he loved her very much. He really and truly did. Even if he couldn't stop thinking about Missy, it didn't matter to him. She was nothing. In a daze, Charity would say she wanted to know everything that happened between the two of them. She'd say she had to know, so he'd tell her, he said, as best as he could. All right, I'll read this the next more section. It's I can stop there.
Hi, everybody. I'm very happy to be doing this introduction. So just a few observations about Aram and his work. Aram is exceedingly hardworking. Always reading or prepping for an interview or review to put someone else's work on the map. He's a truer literary citizen than anyone I've ever pleasure knowing so personally. He's the kind of person who is open and generous as opposed to reservedly, secretly so, or not at all, who is ever anxious about climate change and recycling. Aram always seems to be listening a bit closer, extending or perhaps exhausting his ability to make the people around him happy or comfortable. In short, it's the kind of person you want to protect, the kind of person you marvel at and wonder how exactly he's managed to retain such passion and goodwill so assertively in adulthood. Such wonder resolves a bit after reading his writing. One gets a differently intimate sense of Aram's generosity and optimism. That the rare brand of tenderness Aram possesses emerges from resigning oneself to, or even accepting what it means to have impossible complications. That endless feeling of entanglement and a composite identification that resists comprehension, that rises and falls, and perhaps unstably so, from the margins, into privilege, and back again. His short story, Waiting for the Rain, is a multi-generational saga that attempts to reconcile the exploits of history from a half-imagined, half-literal motherland to a similarly rendered American landscape in a dizzying pursuit of a sense of home. A shorter piece, entitled Car Crash in Reverse, employs a familiar literary trope for an admirable purpose. The narrator, having caused injuries to his friends after crashing his cars into a telephone pole, works backward to a kind of forgiveness after first sifting through every physical horror of that night. Aram seems to me to always be working toward understanding how to feel about being seen but not understood, or to be a certain kind of understood but not seen. Literary talents derive most clearly from having to assemble and reconcile advantage that allows him to admit, under every well-intentioned upset or failure or offense or ignorance or grievance, is a route to understanding and understanding what's necessary to build toward something better. You'll see what I mean. Aram is a former contributor at Book Riot and editor at large at Chicago Review of Books, and the assistant managing editor at Tricorder. his stories, reviews, interviews, essays, have appeared or forthcoming in the millions, Colorado Review, Joyland, Canadian Review Online, Long Reads, Gigantic Sequence, The Master's Review, Mystery Fiction, Great Lakes Books Project, and a bunch of other stuff. He holds an English degree from Michigan State University, a graduate level publishing certification from the University of Denver, and an MFA in creative writing from Northwestern University. But most fortunately for all of us, he's a PhD student in creative writing from Florida State University and lived in Tallahassee with his fiance Kelsey, his new chocolate puppy, Lucy. And it was a new chocolate puppy, Lucy. Who's not here. Aaron, we're joining everybody.
Leslie, thank you so much. That's probably the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me since I was a kid. I do have a new dog at home, and leaving her every time I leave her is really sad. After Dustin called me tender, I'm actually going to start by reading something kind of angry, so I apologize about that. I know this was billed as a fiction reading, but I'm going to be reading some short creative nonfiction. This first thing is called Animal Kingdom. The president is on television calling people animals. He is not the first. He will not be the last. He is one of many throughout the ages, snarling with glee as he uses one of the oldest tricks in the book. The animal can be labeled a pest, and a pest can be exterminated. A pest can be undone. In fear, predatory nature emerges. Clothing and smartphones and the wonders of modern architecture become nothing more than a facade for our feral roots. Build a wall. Pen the unwelcome. Believe in the salvation of barriers. In a country far away, on what was once the land of another country far away, there is a mountain that they say Noah's Ark came to rest atop. A grand ship measured in cubits, docked high in the sky, loaded to the brim with precious cargo. Long ago, in its hull, the animal kingdom waited for the flood to subside, two of each breed, ready to repopulate the soggy landscape below. Among rotted trees and waterlogged fields, a mushy crust of mud, they return to a land without borders, a map free of demarcation. The colorful menagerie, survivors of a world awash, no longer tethered to the arbitrary boundaries of the past. Legend has it the Ark remains hidden at the summit of Ararat, nestled in the crevices of the frozen peak. When the ice melts and the flood returns, I wonder who will be invited to board this ancient buoyant vessel. Who will weather the planet's second inundation? Who or what will survive? Perhaps the weather-worn cavernous boat is full of holes. Given its lighter load, it could topple in the massive waves, so many of its original couples having long since vanished from the earth. Or maybe the rich will push and pay their way aboard, cram their bodies into every nook and cranny, fill the gaps with their worldly possessions until the beams crack and the joints snap and the cabin collapses so that everything sinks towards the undefined darkness of the ocean floor. And as the waterline rises, and the shores disappear, and the tree line submerges, and the hilltops are baptized, we'll all be left to drown. Oh, you don't worry about clapping in between. That's fine. Thank you, Doug. I'm sorry. Before I moved here, I lived in Chicago, and when I lived in Chicago, one of the great parts about that city is that my ears rang every night before I went to bed, because it's really loud. So this is about tinnitus and living in Chicago. It's called heavy-headed, and hopefully it's a little funnier than that last thing. My head often feels filled with concrete. This is not to say congested. If anything, I am rarely sick. My fiancé supercharges my immune system with daily verdant smoothies. Abundant spinach provides the vibrant green color, but the leaves do little in regard to flavor. Smoothies instead taste like apples and yogurt. Their dairy-like texture clings to the caverns of my gums. Despite the healthy diet, the center of my head regularly seems to solidify. The grit and goop congeals into a brick behind my eyeballs. I often wonder about the cause. Does it have to do with my sedentary desk job, my tendency to wear clothes inappropriate for the weather, the lake effect wind funneling into the caverns of my face? I stare off at random corners of rooms when I try to think of words. In our apartment, I flop across the area rug when my head feels heavy, as if it has anchored my body in place. My limbs float away outward from my skull. Sometimes I like to imagine the ceiling fan looks like a man with a tall flat top making a snow angel, but the white paint on the ceiling is not soft enough to actually resemble snow. It is more like a layer of dried gray yogurt. If we had a dog, we do now. If we had a dog, these are the moments she would come lick my face while I lay on the floor and mirror the fan man, but we are still in school. Our finance is inert. So for the time being, we treat our houseplants like pets instead, because they are all we can afford. Their names are Goldie and Planty. Goldie is now the snake plant, though the Polish florist down the street assured me otherwise upon point of purchase. We later bought a snake plant, which died and was replaced by Planty. You're not supposed to be able to kill snake plants, but we drowned the damn. You're right. We fretted too much over its survival, bonded to fatality. I guess the platitudinous moral here is that everything dies eventually. Whenever I rise from the rug, my back cracks at several vertebrae. I can't rest for long because there are always more things to be done around the apartment. Coffee to brew, lunches to prepare, emails to send, surfaces to wipe down, books to read, books to donate, dust to scoop from the furniture to the floor. Sometimes I forget my keys to the apartment and get locked out, in which case I camp in the stairwell and study. I worry about the amount of recycling we create. There are so many bottles and bins. We started buying biodegradable dish soap to be friendlier to the environment, but the fake smell of Paris has been disappointing. The blinds must be perpetually open and closed, depending on the time of day. I wonder how often the neighbors across the courtyard see me traipsing about in my underwear as I attempt to shake the wax out of my ears. I bob my head from side to side in hopes it will assuage the pressure of my clogged canals. Anything to lighten the load. Each morning, I check the time and temperature in the bottom right corner of the local news as I prepare to walk to the train. Before I leave, Goldie and Planty are each given a cup of tap water, placed in the sun, and occasionally sprinkled with a spoonful of damp leftover coffee grounds from the filter. Given our hectic schedules, they have lived longer than we could imagine, especially considering the lack of air conditioning and our general forgetfulness. Somehow, they stay with us. Each morning, I kiss my fiance on the way out the door and glance back at the houseplants. Those two are survivors, I think, and we won't let them drown anytime soon. So, a couple fun things about that. One, Goldie and Planty are both still alive. So that's, Planty is with us in Tallahassee, but Goldie wasn't doing well, so we sent her to Kelsey's mom's house, which is like she's like the plant doctor, so she's fixing it for us. And we also got a dog now, and this morning I was reading this on the floor because that's where I like to lay, and she came up and licked my face, so it's like I predicted what was going to happen. Dustin, again, I want to thank you for engaging with my work. He talked about one of the essays I'm reading right now, which is called A Car Crash in Reverse, which is about a really serious car wreck I was in when I was 16. And I didn't write anything about it until this summer, 13 years after the fact. So this is still a little rough, but this is what I tried to make of it. So this is Car Crash in Reverse. Before T scrambled across a stranger's yard with blood gushing down his forehead, and L's jaw was wired shut, so that for years you scanned her face for subtle changes in its landscape. And these fractured femurs left her in a wheelchair for weeks, later on crutches. Before the telephone pole demolished the straight grin of your station wagon and the front end caved in, so that it resembled the yawning mouth of a crocodile. Before the airbag pummeled its acrid taste into the cracks of your bleeding lips and rattled your neck with a full-face sucker punch. Before you took a left turn too wide while you glanced past your friends crammed in the back seat, unbuckled, cozy, elated in evading curfew. Before you veered onto the dim-lit street, headed downtown for cheap sandwiches and wet cans of pop, ready to dig the last crumpled dollars from your wallet, before careening out of the empty middle school parking lot, thirsty for what the rest of the night held, before you plopped down in the driver's seat, when the car was parked and empty, the warm engine dozing in the first minutes of the morning, before declining to joint past your way on the row of weekend swings, insistent on driving sober, before the cool night crept over the six of you as you hid from homework and midterms and the mundane stresses of a fleeting weekend, still believing that nothing could go wrong, the crepuscular chill of possibility sending goosebumps across your forearms in the wind, before patiently descending a ladder from the roof of the school where you had boosted one another atop its lower tier and climbed in a single file to its damp summit. Before the months of wreckage, you were simply overjoyed to be out, after hours, beneath the unclouded night sky, stretching to reach a little closer to the stars. All right, this is the last little thing I got. For those of, I guess my writing is mostly a lot about Armenian stuff, Armenian ethnic identity, and in writing that, some complications have just come up as far as how I feel about it and a lot of the ways I think about pandering. And so this is something I wrote a while ago called How to Exploit Your Ancestors, kind of dealing with that. So how to exploit your ancestors. Begin by orienting yourself to the genocide that most closely aligns with your cultural identity. In this case, let's say Armenia. Learn your family history. Ask relatives for their passed down stories and recollections, the artifacts buried in the basement storage closets and notes scrawled across the margins of moldy Bibles. Soak up every obscure detail of your family tree. Create a geography of displacement. Fill in the blanks with facts derived from academic texts. Research is key. Upon introduction, do not correct people when they add an ethnic cadence to your first name, and smile politely when they don't bother to attend your last. In school, when teachers take roll call, shout here before they even make a go at it. This will happen several times a day. Identify telemarketers by their mispronunciation. Tell them Mr. Joyen no longer lives here. Whether at the grocery store or another shopping outlet, make a point of reading the tag on every item you buy to confirm it is not a product of Turkey. This is especially important when purchasing apricots, bathroom linens, and Haribo gummy bears. At cafes, never order Turkish coffee, regardless of the roast country of origin. Learn to cook garlic-heavy ethnic food. Fill your kitchen with fresh lavash and fragrant like rice pilaf. Season your lamb with abandon. Make baklava from scratch, even though you lack the delicate touch to work with phyllo dough. Add lahmacun and torchy to your short stories. When the girl you date briefly after college refers to you as caramel-colored, do not remind her you're both Polish. Never forgive her. Never give her the opportunity to compare your pasty thighs to your much tanner face. Let imaginations run wild at your ethnic ambiguity. Make strangers guess a few times. Once they've pinned you down, remind them often that your ancestors suffered and survived. Write the stories of your distant relatives as if you have ownership over them. Use the word disembowel to describe the death of your pregnant great aunt. Fill your writing with bloodstained bayonets and torrid deserts and death marches. Include words like atrocity and annihilation as much as possible. Steal Peter Balakian's ideas about the transmission of trauma. Provide personal context to your transgenerational grief. Show them you're pissed off. Tell them to. Write about it again and again until it becomes your niche, the ethnic signature of your artistic vision. At readings, tell your audience the notorious Hitler quote. Okay, so the notorious Hitler quote is this one that Hitler is attributed to, saying that says, "Who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of Armenians?" And that was said as justification for the Holocaust. So now you know the notorious Hitler quote. Inform your listeners, Turkey still jails journalists to this day. When all is said and done, you'll feel no closer to figuring out who you are. You will still feel separated from the past. You will think yourself a coward, a pretender, a boy using his funny name as a crutch. But remember, you are a product of survival. You are the living proof. How you live is up to you, isn't it? Thank you.
All right, let's have another round of applause for our readers. Be so kind as to bus your dishes back to the kitchen. We appreciate it.
We hope to see you all here next week for Rita Mukherjee and Zach Ringy.